Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to day two of the LSE's festival. My name is Richard Davis. I'm a professor here at the LSE. I teach in the School of Public Policy, and it's my first job to welcome you all and also to welcome our online audience. The LSE Festival has a theme each year. This year it is power and politics, very suitable. We have a fantastic set of events all week. I believe there are programmes at the back, and you can also find the information at lse.ac.uk/festival. Tonight, though, we're going to focus on the UK. The country goes to the polls in 3 weeks, so whatever its political hue, we will have a new government. The question is, and the question for tonight, what should that government do? There are a host of problems which makes this a tough question. Low investment, low productivity, low wage growth, a low rate of house building. If you will, Britain is kind of running in the sand. And what we need is a jetpack. The question is, how do you build that jetpack? Luckily, I've got four fantastic panellists here who are going to help us answer that. So on the far side, we have Soumaya Keynes. She writes about economics for the Financial Times. She also has a fantastic podcast I recommend to all of you, The Economics Show. Next to Soumaya, we have Danny Srishkandaraja. He leads the New Economics Foundation. They set out novel, challenging, really cutting-edge ideas that policymakers should think about. He previously ran Oxfam here in the UK, so has a host of policy experience. Next to Danny is Sam Richard. Sam heads up Britain Remade. He has a wealth of policy experience too, including at Downing Street, and his new project has loads of ideas about how to get Britain going again. And then next to me, we have Isha Nelson. She writes about economics and business for the New York Times. Previously, she was at Quartz, and she's won lots of awards, including for the leading young financial and economic journalist. Before handing over to them, some housekeeping. Twitter, or X, I should say, the hashtag is LSE Festival. The session is being recorded. We hope to make it into a podcast, so please, I'm going to do it now. Everyone do it. Put your phone onto silent. You will get a good chance to speak to and challenge and question this panel at the end. So get your questions ready. And if you're online, I've got a nice iPad here, which is going to show me your questions, so do get them in. So I'm going to hand over to the panel, and I'd like 3 to 4 minutes on your prescription for Britain, your diagnosis and then your prescription. But we also want to make this as engaging and as personal as possible. So before that, I'd like 20 seconds from each of you. Where did you grow up, or where are you from? And there are lots of students in the audience. What is your number one book on economics or policy or things that people should read? So I will start to show you how short I'd like it to be. My name's Richard. I was born in Derby. I grew up on the south coast of the UK in a town called Weymouth. I think the best book on economics, because it's about economics, how it should be, is a book called Almost Everyone's Guide to Economics. It's by J.K. Galbraith. So I'll go to, because I've worked with her before, I like to pick on her. Soumaya, you go next.
Hi, I'm Soumaya. I was born in Islington. I grew up in Islington. And given that Richard very kindly promoted my podcast, I'm going to repay the favour and say the best book that you all should read is a book called Extreme Economies, What Life at the World's Margins Can Teach Us About Our Own Future. Extreme Economies will get you there. It's so good. I'm not just saying that because I'm on the panel.
Okay, thank you. We will have an argument tonight, I promise. Danny.
Hi, I'm Danny. I was born in Sri Lanka. I grew up in Papua New Guinea in Australia. I've been in this country for about 25 years. I was going to plug my own book, which is out in about 6 weeks, called Power to the People. But E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful, Fritz Schumacher, was an alternative economist who wrote that book, brilliant book, 50 years ago, with some really profound lessons on rethinking what an economy should, how it should work. And I was rereading it recently. I still think it's incredibly profound.
Great. Sam.
All right, my name's Sam. I grew up in West Yorkshire, born and raised there. The book that I recommend, it's more of a shorter paper than a book, but it's called The Housing Theory of Everything, and it's by Sam Bowman, John Myers and Ben Southwood, and explains so much of the stagnation that we've all been living through over the last 15 years.
Thank you. Isha?
I'm Isha. I grew up in Reading, so not too far. I made it a little bit further away from home. The book I would recommend is called All the Houses I've Ever Lived In, Finding a Home in a System That Fails Us by Kieran Yates, which came out quite recently. I feel like it's just a good example of a specific issue as opposed to all econ things.
Brilliant, thank you. So that's your panel, all human beings, as you can see. I'm going to go first for the introduction. I think, in mine I sort of said, Britain's stuck in the sand, we need a jetpack. That's kind of what you guys at Britain Remade are arguing for, isn't it, Sam? So why don't you give us 3 to 4 minutes on what you think should be done?
Sure thing. So for those of you who don't know, Britain Remade is a campaign for economic growth. What does that really mean? It is a campaign to get stuff built. We think that underpinning almost all of our current, we talked about the host of problems that you said that we had, and underpinning the high cost of energy for both consumers and for our businesses is the fact that it's too hard to build stuff. We haven't built a new nuclear power station in 29 years. We have banned building onshore wind in England. It takes 13 years to get a new offshore wind farm up and running, despite the fact that actually building the thing takes just 2. The rest of the time spent is all in planning. And this is in stark contrast to other countries who do actually build stuff. So France have been shielded from the gas crisis that we've had in recent years, in part because they actually built a fleet of nuclear reactors. So that's energy. And the same is true on transport and on housing, that our planning system makes it far too hard to actually build the stuff that we need. So to go on transport, France, again, is a very good example. It costs 9 times less to build new high-speed rail in France, partly this is a question of population density, but it is also the case because of the peculiarities of our planning systems, the way that we gold plate environmental impact assessments. We have made it far harder than we need to. And housing is, of course, the paradigmatic example about this that we're all living through. We all know that we pay far too much in rent. We all know that our mortgages cost far too much. And at the heart of that has been our failure to build the new homes that we need. So what can we expect in the next 5 years? This is what is slightly heartening, is the fact that both major parties now, and we've seen the Conservative Party's manifesto today, and they have committed to a range of policies on speeding up new infrastructure, changing the way that we do consultations, changing the way that we do environmental impact assessments. But it's also the case that the Labour Party have said that they want to be on the side of the builders and not the blockers, that they want to bulldoze through the planning system. And I think that that is going to be the central debate of the next Parliament, because on all of Labour's, it's very likely that we'll have a very large Labour majority, and on all of Labour's core promises, from a 2030 zero carbon grid to the 1.5 million homes that they have said that they need to build, on all of them, they are going to have to deliver the planning reform in order to do that. And that could be the jetpack to lift us out of our host of problems.
Brilliant, thank you. Planning is a jetpack. That's, you heard it here first. Isha.
Yeah. So I guess my job is to try and explain Britain for an international audience, often an American one, but just a broadly international one. And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, the claim that the UK has currently turned a corner. I think you've heard the Prime Minister recently. That's really his bid for why the election was called now. There was some okay-ish GDP data, there was some okay-ish inflation data, and it felt like a good moment to say, okay, things are looking better. And he said, this is going to be the fastest growing economy in the G7. And I think, some of that is very fair. I do feel like you can't completely ignore the fact that this first quarter was a little better. But if I take a step back and I think kind of more big picture, the UK, you have to kind of think about where we've come from. And that's that really, really long period of productivity stagnation and just wage stagnation. And I think that's where it becomes quite difficult to kind of wave such a strong flag for the UK. I think about kind of the post-pandemic recovery. We were all hit by a shared challenge, a shared public health challenge, but the responses to it were really, really different. And the US has created its kind of its own particular situation where it's had very, very strong economic growth. It's up nearly 9% GDP since the beginning of the pandemic. But along with that, it has this kind of nasty inflation problem that it can't seem to quite solve. The UK doesn't have it quite so bad on inflation. It is coming down, but we do still have a much slower recovery than the Eurozone as a whole. The Eurozone has grown about 3.5% since then. But also, you know, there is some room to say, okay, we are going to make international comparisons. The UK is not doing terribly. Germany gets to be the one that says it's doing worse. German economy has really, really struggled because of its kind of focus on manufacturing. It's the fact that the energy price shock was so, so painful there. Many industries, so much industry is still feeling the damaging effect of that, and its focus on China and China's economy is, you know, I can't pretend that any of us have great insight into what is precisely going on in China, but what we do know is that that's led to kind of less demand, and that's hurting Germany. So I think the UK wants to kind of think about its place in the world, and I do think there is going to have to be a real focus to really grapple with that, I think, going forward. We can't kind of say, well, we want to have an open economy, we want to kind of be free trading and not think too much about what the rest of the world is doing. There is a lot of hand-wringing at the moment around this kind of block around China, this block around the US, the increasing tensions they have, where Europe sits in the middle of that. We're about to see kind of Europe's retaliation to China on some tariffs and electric vehicles and solar panels and things like that. And I think one of the challenges for the UK is kind of thinking about, again, like, where is its place in this international order and kind of grappling honestly with how that's changed. And I'm going to bring it up quickly and painfully and just say the Brexit word, because every time I write an article about the UK, people want to still know, are we kind of fully understanding what that has led to and what can be used to take advantage of it or needs to, like, you know, what does it actually mean? I think we're aware that in this kind of current campaigning season, we don't like to talk about it too much.
Yeah, and trade really hasn't come up at all, I would say, or hasn't been a major focus of any of the debates we've had. This is a good opportunity for me to have do a quick advert. So I've come to these events for about 20 years at the LSE, and they're always great. I hope tonight will be great. But sometimes you can go away and think, oh, I wish I knew that fact or what they were talking about. So we've tried something new tonight, which is you should all have a little bookmark, which you can take away from with you about tonight's event. And you can scan the QR code and find your way to a page, which will have lots of charts. And over the course of the next couple of days, we'll put any reports, any things we refer to on that page. So if in a couple of weeks, if you are a student or if you're just interested, and you decide I want to click on that QR code or scan that QR code, you'll find your way to the charts. There are already charts on there, including one, Isha, to your point about the long run of UK productivity and how basically output per hour goes up and up and up and then flatlines for a period. Now, this is some of the stuff, Danny, that Sam's ideas would tackle. It's all going to cost money. Really interested to hear your perspective from Neff, but in particular, whether you were or weren't going to talk about it, this idea that there might be a windfall gain to be had by changing the way the Bank of England works.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because colleagues at New Economics Foundation have been working on a whole range of ideas, one of which the Financial Times has been championing in the last few days, which is this notion of changing the sort of creating tiered reserves at the Bank of England. So the Bank of England holds all sorts of deposits from commercial and other banks. We pay, or the Bank of England pays on our behalf, standard interest rates. Our idea is to create a tiered system so that some basic holdings of banks at the Bank of England are paid at a lower interest rate, saving potentially billions and billions of pounds. It's a relatively straightforward measure that could be easily done. It would cost the banks in terms of profits and dividends, but, you know, loosen the pressure on the fiscal purse. And it is that sort of thinking we need, I think, because, you know, if we're to have any chance of making the sort of investments needed in the sorts of things these guys have talked about, I think the first thing I would hope a new government can do is to sort of challenge or change the so-called fiscal rules that sort of a generation of politicians seem to have accepted are what's going to bind us. To me, that's ludicrous. We need public and private investment if we're going to have any chance of driving growth. In order to do that, we will need to be sensible about what we invest in. And so why bind ourselves to some arbitrary rules around, you know, to say the debt to GDP ratio will reduce over 5 years? We need new thinking around that, and I think it's credible to do that in a more nuanced way. Colleagues at NEF have the idea of replacing the so-called fiscal rule with a set of fiscal referees, independent experts who can judge in a more nuanced way when borrowing is acceptable for particular types of investment. And so there are all sorts of different ways you might cut it. My real worry, and Esha, you said the turning the corner point. So this morning, Rishi Sunak, when launching the Conservative Party manifesto at Silverstone, for those of you who don't know, the UK, Silverstone is a racetrack, and he used this idea that he said Britain's economy has turned a corner and that's why we're at racetrack. And what struck me was that...
I was worried you were going to say he used jetpack.
I'm getting into your jetpack in a sec. No. But the problem is Silverstone is a circular racetrack. And to me, this is the problem. We are, and this is not a party political point, because I really worry that most of our major parties are good at giving us a short-term manifesto or short-term vision that will inevitably take us around and round in circles without the sort of fundamental step change we need on a range of things, whether that's green investment to drive a fast, fair, deep transition, or whether that's resetting the welfare system so it's worthy of a society that calls itself civilized. You know, we have had politicians from all major parties chipping away at the basic levels of social protection so that we have millions of people in society today who are on so-called universal credit, you know, the sorts of benefits that we think should entitle everyone in our society to the basic minimum. And yet millions and millions of those people can't even afford the basic essentials to get by. And so whether it's green investment or resetting the welfare system, I think we do need to change the rules through which the state can borrow, can invest, can pump prime a more inclusive growth.
And would you... So the way those fiscal rules work... and you can all correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the intuition is debt has to be falling at the end of the government's forecast. So what this means is any new chancellor can come in, say I have these new plans, and in 5 years' time debt's going to be falling, but it's only that fifth year. So in years 1, 2, 3, 4, it can be going up. And so the result we've had is people able to meet that rule with debt always falling and debt always going up. Now, would you, under this system of referees, are you at NEF comfortable with actually a bit more debt? Because we had the experience of the mini budget and the kind of big rise in yields. Now, and I guess there are two completely different schools of thought on that. One could say, well, that was a sign that Britain is kind of as much debt as it can take, right? Because the markets responded. Somebody could equally reasonably say, yeah, but it came in the context of extreme political uncertainty, firing the head of the Treasury, ignoring the OBR, all that kind of stuff. So just as a quick response, you at NEF think that, you know, maybe Italy and Japan are kind of okay signals as to how much debt a country can withstand, or are you arguing for a kind of similar level of debt but just more stimulative spending within that envelope?
So I think the important thing to recognise is that not all debt is the same. If you're borrowing genuinely to invest, then you know you need to price that in and perhaps treat that sort of debt differently. You might tweak, you know, you might stick to a similar formula by lengthening the period that you're projecting. So the five-year rule, extend that to 10 years, and what that should do is allow you to calculate the returns, particularly on green investment, over a longer horizon, which will be accrued later, given the sort of scale of projects that we're talking about. So there are tweaks to the system that I think will allow us the greater headroom without sort of throwing... I mean, I'm not saying, you know, let's throw out all the rules. I'm saying, let's, you know, these are human-made rules, and these are relatively new constraints
And so let's think again about what are the rules we need for the era that we're in and the levels of public investment that are inevitably going to be needed.
Thank you. Now, questions are already coming in from the people watching online, so thank you. Do keep them coming in. So, Mayor, we've heard a bit about, we heard about Brexit, I mentioned the mini budget, we've heard about the US and China, what's going on there. This all adds up to a lot of uncertainty. This is something you've been thinking about recently. I want to definitely ask you about that. But also, you know, you've worked as a policy advisor before going into journalism. What are the kind of things you'd be hoping that a new Chancellor, a new PM would have on their desk?
Okay, well, I'm going to do those in the order in which you asked them. So uncertainty is something I've been thinking a lot about, right? And so this is something that the Labour has said that they want to change. One of the big criticisms of the Conservative government is that there has just been a lot of flip-flopping, a lot of chopping and changing, a lot of uncertainty introduced by things like Brexit, introduced by the lettuce incident, and various other essentially what's perceived in some cases a kind of unseriousness or a lack of focus or a lack of planning. And so Labour has said, okay, well we want to change that. And one of just some examples of things that they've promised to do include they're just going to have one budget a year. So no more fiddling around with everything twice a year. I'll believe it when I see it. When my sort of hunch is that politicians quite like the opportunity to fiddle. But sure, I'll take their word for it. And then also the Office of Budget Responsibility. I think one of the things they're going to do is set out kind of costs and benefits of long-term investment plans, I think with the idea that they would then become harder to cancel. And so the question is, how much could this deliver? I'm very in favour of kind of setting out plans more clearly. One of the other complaints is that the government has occasionally announced things at a very high level and then not set out with sufficient detail how they're going to tender or when they're actually going to do it. And so if you're a company hoping to make the investments to actually deliver those promises, to take part in that kind of procurement process, it's very, very difficult because you just don't actually, you need the details of what they're going to do. So it's possible that Labour's going to sort of change all of these things. It's going to be more boring. It's not going to, severely disrupt relations with its largest and closest trading partner. It's harsh to that again, but I think they're hoping to make that a more stable relationship. And it's possible that when it comes to things like the green transition, they'll be more clear about what they're going to do, and also just kind of happier to spell out that they are going to spend money on investment. So I wanted to do a kind of back of the envelope calculation. So I'm in favour of this, but I wanted to know, okay, well, how much could it really deliver? So there have been some academics that looked at a measure of policy uncertainty in the UK over time, and it really has been all over the place. The past sort of decade and a half have not been great for policy uncertainty, according to this index.
So this is Nick Bloom at Stanford.
This is, a group of economists at Stanford. Nick Bloom, Steve Davids.
Of British fame, originally.
That's Britain there, don't you worry. And so they've done research basically looking to see at the relationship between changes in this uncertainty index and actual economic outcomes, right? So from that, you can sort of do back of the envelope. Okay, well, if uncertainty fell from, say, 110 to about 100, it's an index, it's kind of hard to think about those figures, but that's not an unreasonable change. If you thought that there would be not an unreasonable reduction in the amount of uncertainty, the kind of awkward news is that it's going to get you a bit of a bump. So I read about this, you might get a bump to industrial production of maybe 0.1% to 0.7%. So industrial production sort of GDP. I'm not going to say no to 0.1% to 0.7% of GDP, but it's not going to be transformational. And then the effect on investment could be between maybe 0.7% and maybe a 4% bump to investment. Again, I'm not going to say no. But given the gaps of investment in the UK compared to other countries, given where we need to get to in terms of net zero, I'm a bit worried that it's gonna help a bit, but it's not gonna sort of get us where we want to go to. Now, there's a caveat, right, which is that this index that I'm talking about really does measure short-term uncertainty, right? So it measures the trust debacle and Brexit and sort of changes that are reported on in the news. It doesn't do a great job, probably, of picking up that kind of long, lingering uncertainty associated with, well, they're just not saying anything about these particular plans, and so we can't do anything. And so it's possible that actually, if the next government sets out more of a vision, is clear about its plans, there could be a bigger effect. There could be a more positive effect from these better vibes. You know, multinational corporations think that the UK is just a better place to do business. Maybe. Let's hope so. But on the other side of things, my other worry is that the rest of the world is not going to stand still, right? So it's possible Labour could become much more boring. That could deliver a bump to investment and growth. But the rest of the world might become much less boring. It's quite a scary place out there. We've got odds of Trump winning the election much higher than I would like. You know, and if that happens, you've got geopolitics going. You know, I'm an economics person or a geopolitics person. The geopolitics stuff is really scary. Middle East, Taiwan, and even on the economic side, it's not entirely comforting. You know, as Isha mentioned, we've got issues about you know, how China is trying to prop up its domestic economy by essentially subsidising particular industries involved in the green transition. I don't think they understand how that's going to be received by Europe, the UK, the US. It's not going to be a case of, oh, great, thanks for subsidising all this cheap green stuff, thank you. No, that's not going to happen. There's probably going to be some kind of trade barriers, retaliation, and you know that could get quite nasty quite quickly.
Okay, so that's interesting and quite concerning. So just to massively simplify what you're saying is there is this kind of idea in economics that there's almost like a free good when it comes to uncertainty. Because often what we talk about, and we'll talk about it in a minute, you know, you come have some idea, you need some certain amount of money to spend on it. But with uncertainty, the idea is you can come up with a new system of policy frameworks. And we saw this in an associated way with the rise of independent central banking, where basically if you just have better economic policies, it's not a question of spending more money. The inflation rate can come down, the investment rate goes up, yields on bonds go down, and it's kind of free in that sense. But you're sort of saying, actually, first, the effect might be pretty small. And second, this has been a very domestically focused election. And I think we can very clearly see from what has been going on with China. Look at, for example, what Soumaya's colleague Gillian Tett's been saying at the Financial Times and so on, that the new chancellor is going to be involved in quite an interesting international debate. We shouldn't bank on this. I want to go back, though, to Britain, because we've had a great question from online. I'm going to come to the audience in a second and open it up. But we've seen in France and in Germany over the past few days votes in the European election which have shown strongly in favour of kind of far-right groups. And a lot of the complaints there have been to do with inequality, left-behind areas, and so on. If you were, and I'll give you a break, I did ask it to you, but the question to Soumaya, starting with you, Sam, what would you hope of the things that you've been working on would be on the new Chancellor, the new PM's desk, but specifically that would help with that problem, would help, if you like the phrase levelling up, use the phrase levelling up, if you like the phrase quashing inequality, bringing left-behind areas back to the forefront?
Well, look, as part of the campaign, we've been right around the country, and the number one issue that everyone has raised has been the cost of energy. Britain had higher energy costs before gas prices went up by 200% after Putin's invasion of Ukraine. So one of the best things that the incoming government could do would be, firstly, immediately, fully lift the ban on the cheapest source of energy, onshore wind, that currently exists in England. The government has changed the policy slightly, but effectively there is still a ban on building new onshore wind in England. And then secondly, as I say, that broader reform of the planning system to speed up the building of cheap new renewables and nuclear. I mean, it's also the case that a lot of these areas that we're looking to level up have strong heritage in these industries. So Anglesey, Cumbria are the places where we had our first fleet of nuclear power stations, and they are crying out for more nuclear power. Teesside, where the steel was built that currently holds up the Sydney Harbour Bridge, could also be, and is, we're starting to see the new factories for offshore wind being built there. So I would say, yeah, number one, making it easier to build new sources of energy. Just very quickly, though, if I may, on the point around investing in the green transition and the need then to change fiscal rules in order to do that, if you spoke to Greg Jackson, who's the CEO of Octopus Energy and an actual real British success story over the last 15 years, he would not say that what they need is large amounts of government subsidy and government cash. What they need is the fundamental changing in the rules to make it easier for them to build stuff. There is the private sector capital there to build the wind turbines, the solar panels, the grid connections, but unfortunately we make it far too hard to allow them to actually do that. And if you just flood in with lots of public sector cash, but without the planning reform to do it, all you will get is resultant inflation.
Okay, thank you. So clearly a big programme on energy. Danny, what would be your number one thing on the Chancellor's desk?
I'd underline the sort of need to invest in renewables. So if the question is about the sort of, you know, buying people back into a sort of shared economic project, then whatever you want to call it, inclusive development, democratizing our economy, whatever it is, we need to find better ways of leveling the playing field. Leveling up is another phrase that's been used here. And I think that's, for me, one of the fundamental messages that I'm hearing across the world, which is people are turning off mainstream political parties, or mainstream politics even, because they don't feel that they've got a stake in the economy. Inequality is rising in almost every country in the world. And very few politicians seem prepared to do much about it, right? I mean, in the 2 years since the pandemic began, the world's billionaires, 3,500 of them, accumulated a greater increase in wealth than the previous 14 years put together. And so here we were in this shared pandemic, the great leveler, people were calling it, that we were all in this together, humanity would come together. Turns out, those who had wealth accumulated eye-watering levels of more wealth, and our politicians feel unable or unwilling to do much about it.
But let's pause on that for a second. Importantly, to clarify a little bit, make sure we're all on the same page as to actually what's going on, and then I'm going to press you for an actual policy, which you do, which is that in the UK, actually, what I would argue, and you guys might argue something different, the income inequality we should care about, which is that between people in the middle, the 50th percentile, and the people at the bottom, the 10th percentile, so a very low earner and a kind of median earner, is really, really low, and it's about as low as it's ever been, and that's because of the minimum wage. And in a way, that's a sort of optimistic thing, because it tells you we've had cross-party agreement, right? The minimum wage came in 1997. Everyone said, well, there's going to be huge unemployment. There wasn't. We brought in the Low Pay Commission. We got experts to look at it. And actually now there's really strong cross-party agreement that the minimum wage is helpful. So that's an example of what was definitely a problem and something that policy has been helped tackle. There's another way of looking at inequality. Don't want to get too jargonistic here, which is whether so this is all about income. There's other ways to make money, which is the money that capital gets, so the owners of the firm. And that's where the billionaires are. This is not to do with people's pay packets. People's pay packets actually in the UK have become a bit more equal. It's that the whole pie, more of it is going to those that own the shares, have big significant stakes in companies. So what would you actually do? I mean, one idea from what I've just said is actually much stronger policies which give workers ownership rights of their firms, because then when there's a big dividend, they'll get a bit of it. Is that something NEF would support? What other things could be done?
Yeah, absolutely. So just on your earlier point, you're right. And part of the reason why returns to capital have been sort of outstripping returns to labour is because we are very bad at taxing wealth or the income derived from wealth, and politicians seem actively scared to confront that. And so one of the first things a new chancellor can do is to institute a better set, you know, a better system for taxing wealth, or at least the proceeds of wealth, capital gains or whatever, and level it up to those, the taxes that we pay on income. It's a huge opportunity. The G20 summit will be November in Brazil. President Lula is hosting it. And what he wants to do is a G20 coordinated effort on a new regime of wealth taxes. Because for this to have any chance of working, it does need to have, you know, have international cooperation. So that's a very practical thing. But Richard, on your point about, yes, there are, you know, coming back to sort of the British heritage, you know, this country pioneered cooperatives and the cooperative movements, right? And we should be reinvesting in mutuals, in cooperative community banks, in employee-owned enterprises. It's so easy to do, and it would give you the economic dividends of people actually having more of a purchase or ownership of the economy, but it would also, I think, give us a political dividend that people feel more empowered to have a say in what's going on around them. And so I think that is, making that easier would be an obvious thing and a low-cost thing for a new government to do.
Okay, great. So we've got new regulations to allow employees to own their own firms, concrete proposal. We've got a very clear concrete proposal on squeezing some money out of the Bank of England. I will just have that checked because I did work for the Bank of England for 6 years. They're going to pay my pension at some point, so I do want that policy checked. We're going to have some new wealth taxes, very clear concrete proposal. We have steps to eradicate uncertainty from our system. I want to get to the audience within 2 minutes, but Sumaya and Isha, anything, any last-minute memos that you're going to throw onto the Chancellor's table for day one?
I'll do one because you mentioned the European Parliament elections, and I think one of the things that definitely came out of that was a sense of some voters feeling kind of dragged along unfairly with environmental and green policies. And I think to think about something the UK has done very well is its kind of reduction in emissions. And it's noticing the shift in the conversation to being about the burden on individuals in taking this forward, I think is a real shame. And one of the things I'd want to see is that sense of these are policies, you know, I feel like the train has left the station on net zero, and it's politically getting harder, and it depends on where you are, but this is an opportunity to kind of stay on it, but to admit that it does require real public and government investment on supporting households. I do think businesses are there and they have the capital and they want the ability to build and they want the ability to get the grid electrified and they want to do all those things. But in terms of individual people and households, I think way, way, way more needs to be done to help people rather than use it as kind of a fear-mongering stick in the election, because otherwise you do go back to this point of inequality. There will be the households who can afford to do the efficiency stuff and bring down the own energy bills, and the households that can't afford to do it and will be stuck with those higher things. So I do worry about that sense of like this thing that we were doing quite well and just kind of being used in the kind of political games in a way that we saw it turn quite nasty in the European Parliament elections.
Okay, thank you. That's a really important point. So now you've got 1 minute. You did used to work at the Treasury. You're in the Treasury.
For about 5 minutes.
Late at night. Throw that memo on. What is it? Tax something, subsidize something.
Tax is going to be my thing. I basically would, this is deeply unpopular, I would never get elected on this, but I would want to reform the way that we tax housing. At the moment, there's a big exemption in inheritance tax. I would remove that. I would reform the way we calculate council tax. And, you know, in my dream world, I would change the way we tax capital gains on housing, but that would really get me thrown out of any kind of political establishment. So
those are the sort of dream worlds that economists live in.
Can I just come very quickly?
One quick point, then I'm going to...
Just one final point, and this is slightly tangential, and it's quite controversial, but I think it is really worth airing in the context of this conversation, because we've talked about these results only in the context of inequality, but there is one concern that unites the people who voted for all of these parties and indeed is currently driving reforms numbers, and that is about immigration, and we have to have that conversation honestly.
Okay, thank you. Okay, over to you guys. I think we've got microphones. Yeah, we've got somebody here in the front. And I'll take three at a time, and if you could say where you're from as well, that'd be helpful. And then there's a gentleman here in a grey suit. Next, yes.
I'm Regan. I'm an A-level student from London. You guys are talking about change in wealth taxing. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm assuming that it will most likely affect richer people who earn more, and so they'll be taxed more, and it might slightly reduce taxes or maybe increase taxes for more working-class people. But what policies do you think should be implemented to directly help those being most affected by the cost of living crisis? And you were talking about the necessary welfare reforms. Within that, what do you mean? What do you think is necessary to reform the welfare system and benefits?
Thank you. Great question. There's a gentleman down here in a grey suit. Yeah.
Good evening. John Robson. I'm a retired lawyer. I was just wondering about going back to the old major construction projects, revisiting the northern legs of HS2, the Lower Thames Crossing, the third runway at Heathrow, the dualling of the A1 from Morpeth to Berwick, and perhaps also military Keynesianism, as people have been saying, we need to get more tanks, more planes for the aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
What about that?
Great question, thank you. And then there was a lady there with a black top, with her hand really high.
Hi, you. I'm Francesca. I'm an accountant from London. You've mentioned briefly productivity. I was just wondering whether you could speak a bit more about Britain's productivity puzzle, what's caused that, and how one can improve that.
Brilliant. Okay. Let's start, I think, with John's question, and I think probably that's in your area. You can start, Sam, and anyone else come in. There's lots of hands, so I'm going to give... We'll go through them all, but why don't you answer that one?
Sure. In short, I agree. The planning application for the Lower Thames Crossing cost more to write than it cost Norway to actually build the world's longest tunnel. So I agree.
You're saying the paper?
Yeah.
The paper.
The paper, literally just the planning document.
Wow. So that's
more.
Consultants.
So that's consultants, it's lawyers.
That's what you call a killer fact.
And time, how long?
It's kind of like if you lay it end to end on A4 sheets, it is five times longer than the Lower Thames Crossing itself. It weighs as much as, I think, three polar bears. This just shows you that I agree. There is absolutely a scope for us building big infrastructure projects, but at the moment it's basically impossible in this country as a result of our planning system.
Can I ask a kind of follow-up question? Sorry.
Go on, sorry.
To be clear, I'm in your camp. Let's go, let's build. The kind of complaint or the criticism you sometimes hear, I think, from some on the left is that this is all very well, but, democracy is important, right? So what about the people who can't sell their homes because, there's plans for a railway to go through them and, they haven't been compensated and shouldn't they have a sort of a say, right? I mean, there should be some checks on what happens. How do you... Are you saying that... how do you not go too far, basically? What's reasonable?
Yeah, there definitely should be some checks. I think that the problem is that we've got to the point where absolutely everyone involved in the process doesn't just have a say, but has almost a veto. And it's why, you end up with sort of grotesque chaos with the absurd situation of a planning document costing more than the top. So, yes, you should absolutely, of course, there's still a scope for one round of consultations, but we don't need to have the multiple banks of consultations. I mean, for the Lower Thames Crossing, there is a... they had to undertake a new consultation round on the entire project when they decided to do something slightly different, basically, with the tunnelling machine, that no one plausibly would have any reasonable objections to, but that was then used by people to then question the whole thing and bring the whole project into judicial review. It's that sort of process, because we have to repeatedly consult, I should say.
This benchmarking must help, right? It can't be right for us to be so much slower than how other countries get to it. I want to move on, though. To the question about the wealth tax. And Danny, I'm going to come to you on that one, if it's okay. Do you think a wealth tax would work? And also the second part of the question is, how would that link to policies that would help people facing this cost of living crisis, high inflation, low wage growth?
Yeah, so I think the, you know, one of the things that frustrates me about the current debate about which party is going to tax more or less, because a lot of it is in averages. We get told, you know, this cut in national insurance tax will benefit the average worker by X. The problem is there are already distributional impacts built into that, right? So richer workers better paid workers, the top 20% of workers will get 12 times more on average from a national insurance cut. So we do need to think carefully about distributional impact of taxes and tax cuts. I think wealth taxes can work. They will need to be cleverly designed and internationally coordinated because capital and wealth can move across borders, and we've again allowed that movement. You know, it's willfully blind to capital moving to wherever it's cheapest to be lodged. And I think we need a coordinated effort to do something. And then to your point about the sort of welfare system, you know, one thing that, again, as I said in my opening remarks, that really sort of saddens me is that we can afford to make sure that everyone who's on universal credit has enough to afford the basic essentials. You know, you talked about energy. You know, colleagues of mine have been working on a system of what they're calling a national energy guarantee, rising block tariffs for those of you who are in that world, where you could, you know, if a government wanted to, it could assure every household a set amount of energy at a reduced or highly subsidised amount, so that, again, people have the basic essentials to be able to heat their home, and then have a rising block system for further consumption, so that if you do overconsume, you pay more. So these are not particularly difficult things to design. What's lacking, it seems, is political will to be able to implement them.
Okay, that's brilliant. I'm going to come back to the audience. I'm going to take Francesca's question, if that's okay, because it's something I've worked a lot on. And if you do click on the QR code, click, scan is the word, I think, QR code, you'll see a chart of output per hour, which goes up in the UK, and then it just stops going up at the time of the financial crisis. So what's the problem with that? Well, if you have got, you're getting more output per hour out of your economy, then it's intuitive. At the end of the year, the month, whatever you want to say, the firm has produced more stuff, and it can do lots of things. It can give higher wages. It can reinvest the money in its equipment, or it can give higher dividends. Okay, and those are three really good options, and they all come from productivity. And this is why we as economists go on about productivity. We've had no increase in productivity, really, since then. And lo and behold, we have low wage growth, low investment, and actually, even though it's unpopular to say, relative to other countries, our companies, in terms of their stock market performance, are not doing well. So it's a huge problem. It's the foundational problem for the UK, your question. There's lots of research on it. My best guess is that because it happens at exactly the time of the financial crisis, it's to do with the financial crisis. I don't think we've sorted out the flow of loans to firms in this country since the financial crisis. And we also have seen a slowdown in firms taking one another over and kind of rivalrousness and dynamism, you would call it, amongst UK firms. So I think that's the answer to your question. Okay, let's have three more questions. At the back, oh, there's loads. There's a gentleman right at the back who gets the award for the highest hand. Mm-hmm. And then coming down from him, a girl with a white top on, and then another lady with a beige top on. So this column here. Guy at the back, and then two. Yeah, you, yeah.
Thank you very much. Ali Mirage, LSE alumnus, broadcaster and financier. I think it's really interesting that there's been a lot of talk about planning and about all these things, which all make a lot of sense to me. But there's not been much talk, this evening and also during this election, really about education. Now, we're talking about flatlining productivity for the past 16 years. How are we actually going to educate the next generation with the right requisite skills? And where are we when we compare ourselves to other nations in the world, the emerging China, India, all these people that basically eat our breakfast and already are eating our breakfast? How do we equip the next generations to fight that battle in the global war talent?
Thank you. And then two rows in front, and then three more rows in front.
My name's Talia. I work in investment banking. I'm from Birmingham. Thank you for your good ideas. They're actually the best ideas I've probably heard in any debate. about the upcoming election. So I hope you're in policymakers' ears. I personally think that we do have enough money in the pot from taxation, but we just aren't efficient enough at using it, to your point, the paperwork, the HS2. We're not smart enough about how we're borrowing. Conservatives don't want to raise tax, which I agree with, but they seem very short-sighted on environmental policy, etc. Labour have maybe better long-term plans, but could potentially just spend us into a inflationary hole. Practically speaking, a lot of people here would be on the fence. Who should we vote for? And if I can ask, who are you voting for and two reasons why?
Should we do a poll?
Great question.
Hello.
Me? Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. So I've completely forgotten what the question is now. So the government's FTA program, that's it. So about trade and the dangers of protectionism and how important it is, what do you think about the government's current FTA program? Is there any opportunity in it? Do you think we should just ignore it and, you know, try and rejoin the EU? Do you think, you know, we should be going for more trade deals in new countries? Also, I'm Leila, I'm an economist. Hi.
Okay. Let's come to how we're going to vote right at the very end. Do you want to say that?
Yeah,
Isha, yeah.
I'll leave trade to
say. So Isha, and we need to speed up now because we've got loads of questions and we've got 7 minutes. Okay. So Isha on education and then Sumaya on trade and then we'll have some more. We will answer your question at the end.
No, I'm grateful for the question on education. I think that is the thing that keeps me up at night wondering, you know, about how all the young people that were in school through the pandemic are supposed to catch up and cope, the stress, the like actual mental health crisis that goes on. But I don't just worry about education for young people. I feel like what the UK needs to be much, much stronger at is this kind of question of lifelong learning. Recently, I feel like, despite being an economics reporter, I've spent a lot of time having all these kind of existential conversations about AI, and like lots of people want to believe that this is going to transform everything. This will be the solution to our productivity problem, to answer that question from earlier. And I kind of say, well, sure, but we will need to train people to be able to take advantage of new technologies well, so that we're not all just kind of dummies feeding databases with more information for the eyes and we're not like completely taken over by it. But I do wonder kind of how do we take quite seriously these questions of how do you skill young people, how do you create consistent qualifications for them, how do we make sure that these qualifications are varied and address the skills we need, and then how do we kind of plant that so that people can do that throughout their careers and be a bit more flexible about how they can change, and so that these ideas don't, and this kind of benefits don't just accrue in the few companies that have realized they need to do this and offer lifelong learning programs and offer grants and funds for this, but then everyone gets to experience that, and so it kind of needs to be taken out of just being in companies and be a bit more widely available.
Okay, thank you. And Sumaya, briefly, what would you do on trade?
On trade. Okay, so one, I would acknowledge that FTA is not going to offset the cost of Brexit. Two, I would say if you're going to have a free trade, if you're going to try to do trade deals with countries, make sure that you're actually doing something and not just getting photo ops. There have been a few kind of, they call them kind of memorandums of, basically we got this idea that we would sign trade deals with US states, which was really fun because you got to go and shake hands with an American senator, but they didn't do very much, probably save the plane fare. There are good things, but I think the kind of final point is that you do need to acknowledge that the deeper the trade deal you start agreeing with, you know, countries like the US or India or whatever, the deeper that is, the more the problems that there could arise when trying to strengthen the relationship with the EU. And actually, the EU is really big. It's really near. Maybe let's just try and focus on that first.
Okay. Thank you. I'll go over here. There apparently some people are really keen. There's a guy at the front there. Where?
Oh, it's gone now.
Okay. And then there's a lady next to a guy with a laptop. Yep, there.
Yes, I'm a NSE alumni. What about more devolution to the regions, more power, and more maybe even tax raising revenue, so that public services can meet the needs more closely to the regional bodies?
Thank you. And there's a lady midway up at the back.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi there, my name's Uni Natalia. I do the strategy for an investment fund. So my question is, a lot of these kind of structural changes revolve around vested interests. Does the panel have any thoughts on what could be done to sort of have that structural change?
Vested interests in the sense of people that would not... and then one more, so the loads in the middle. Andres.
Thank you. I'm a professor here of public policy. Two quick ones for Danny. Your emphasis on changing fiscal rules would seem to imply that the problem is a lack of demand, while everything that I've heard so far in this panel suggests the problem is a lack of supply. Productivity is supply. You know, difficulties for building are supply. Mediocre education is supply. So given that we have a fiscal rule which is ludicrous in the sense that it's very easy to avoid, why put the focus on that? That's question number one. Question number two is, I am sympathetic to the idea of a wealth tax, but I'm a little shocked that nobody's mentioned the obvious wealth tax, called a property tax. A property tax. Well, you mentioned it, but in terms of capital gains, I would be much more basic than this. If you buy a flat in New York, which costs $1 million, the first thing that you worry about is property taxes. Council tax in this country is, let's be honest, a joke, right? And it is very regressive because it doesn't go up linearly with the value of the property, or in fact, even non-linearly with the value of the property. So is it simply politics? Is it simply impossible to think that Parliament would pass a property tax bill of the kind that every civilized country has? And if so, if they wouldn't do that, why would they possibly do a wealth tax?
Okay, panel, really short answers now because I want to do one more round and then I want to let people get to their drinks on time. Devolution. Who's got an idea on devolution they would like to... Yeah, go on.
So you're absolutely right. One of the reasons why France is particularly good, why its regions are particularly good at building local transport infrastructure, is because their regional mayors are allowed to borrow in the way that ours aren't. And so one of the things that the next government should do is to give metro mayors exactly that same power.
Just to follow up on that, we seem to be stuck in this sort of bad equilibrium where the centre doesn't trust the... You know, the hub doesn't trust the spokes and therefore doesn't give them power, and so they don't have the chance to earn that trust. So experimenting more, being happier with people failing, I think is the kind of the thing we have to do.
Then vested interests in terms of policy. Well, there's an idea here. So one thing you could do is you could... I'm not 100% sure I'd go down this road, but it's an idea out there. You could just really apply some economics to it and say, well, listen, if you live under Heathrow and you don't like the new runway, we're going to calculate some loss fee for you and going to give you a payment to do that. So some people advocate a planning system which is funded actually to buy people off, to measure their vested interests and to more aggressively give them payoffs. I think there are problems in that, but if we're going to really supercharge planning, you might need some of that in some situations, I think. Let's take that one afterwards over drinks. And then, Danny, you must respond to Andres.
Yeah, I think so. The concern I have is that we're being told by politicians of many major parties that we can't afford to invest in, say, a great homes upgrade to insulate our homes because the public purse is just... is too constrained, and we've got that sort of austerity mentality. And so our starting point is, why design your sort of, you know, an epoch defining sort of moment for us as a society? Why limit yourself to these arbitrary fiscal rules? We need rules,
But let's think about what our era of humanity needs and do it that way, rather than say, we've got these arbitrary rules and we're going to stick by them. And we've talked a bit about the international dimension. You know, we're the only major country cutting our aid budget while hunger and humanitarian emergencies are rising, because we're being told that there's not enough money. So we're not even living up to the very obligations that we laid out and enacted in our law just a few years ago. It's heartbreaking that austerity is costing lives in such direct ways here in this country, but around the world as well.
Thank you, Danny. We started 4 minutes late, so I'm going to give myself 3 minutes. We'll finish at 7:34. There were lots of questions from young people, particularly in the middle here, which I'd like to get to. So there's a guy there with his smart tie on, looking good, sir. Making me feel bad for not wearing one. And then his colleague in front, potentially. Yeah, go for it.
Hi, I'm Ridwan. Naomi, yeah, from London. I just wanted to ask, with the increasing use of AI, and although it would be a good thing for our economy, how would we deal with the threat to workers that comes from it and protect them from consequences such as structural unemployment?
Brilliant question. And then, yeah, in front of you.
Hello, my name is Amir. I'm an A-level student from East London. Danny touched upon this on his last question, but just to elaborate quickly, to what extent do you think austerity is to blame for, you know, the UK's particularly weak post-pandemic recovery, you know, low productivity, low wage growth, etc.? And linked off of that, do you think, you know, perhaps we might have a Labour government come the 5th of July, do you think they're quite hesitant, you know, being quite hesitant on being able to spend quite big? Do you think that's, to use the phrase, setting us back around the racetrack? Or is that going to, you know, do you think their fiscal hesitance is a good or a bad thing?
Great, thank you. And then two behind the original question, yeah, Mauve, is that the right word? Yeah, there, yeah.
Thank you. Is that Mauve? My name is Mandy, I'm an architect. I have a varied questions. The first is perhaps, what should a government subsidise? Here in this country, I'm German originally, every parent deserves an award because they live on the poverty line, because they don't get any support for childcare, for you know, putting these children in the kindergarten and all of this, basically taking out workers out of the market because they have to stay at home rather than doing this. That leads to the next, perhaps, question, the sort of low birth rate. Do we need immigration? That is another question. And then also perhaps education. Also, why is education so expensive? You know, that was an earlier question. Perhaps that should be talked about. And the last one I might fit in is what the gentleman over there said about property. In Germany, as far as I'm aware, you have to keep a property for more than 8 years. Otherwise, you have to pay very high taxes. Over here, it seems to be a hobby that companies buy flats, refurbish them, sell them for twice the price, taking off property that's more affordable from the market, okay, driving up prices. These sort of four varied topics. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Okay, so we need to wrap up now. So what I'd like you all to do is to give your concluding statement, to ask one of those a very eloquent question, which I'll just give into as terrible bullet points. AI versus work, austerity, what should the government subsidise? And in there we had stuff on property and also, really importantly, I think, on demographics, birth rates. So answer one of those, please, only, each of you. And then also I'd like you to give your answer. You don't necessarily have to say which way you would vote. I think that might be. You can say afterwards and drinks for that. But I would like you to say, you know, just looking at the manifestos, what the parties are saying, which one do you think is, you know, got the most interesting economics in it, let's say. I'll start with you at the end, Samir.
Thanks. Okay, I'm just going to pick up on one thing you just said about...
And everyone, all four of you, has to be very brief.
Yeah, the one thing you just said about taxing property. So we have a tax if we move home very quickly. It's called stamp duty, and it's terrible. We should make it much easier for people to move home so that people aren't kind of stuck in houses that are wrong for them. I have a 16-month-old. Please subsidise me. I would really enjoy that. But, you know... And the government is actually rolling out quite large subsidies for childcare, so maybe watch that space. I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to vote. My dad, in 2016, around the Brexit referendum, was so upset by politics that he signed up to all the parties, which we're not allowed to do. It's against the rules. And I've inherited that passion for voting from him. And so I will say that recently I've noticed among people I know there are some people who are planning not to vote, and that is wrong, I believe. So I will be voting. That is my statement.
Danny?
Yeah, austerity has mattered a huge amount. It's profoundly changed people's lives for the worse. And all I can imagine is sort of the Prime Minister driving around the sort of austerity racetrack, around and around in circles, trapped by this sort of orthodoxy of a scarcity mentality when we need fundamental change. And so it's not just about austerity, it's about the choices our leaders make. And Ali, if I can come back to Ali's question about skills, it's a great example of skills and about the question around AI. We need politicians to invest in what my colleagues call a national skilling wage, where people who want to invest in skills are paid a living wage to do so, so given an incentive, and that's paid for by us. We've got a technical fix to reform how we pay for that in a much more effective way. So that's a choice that politicians can make to invest in young people's future. And the problem, which comes back to vested interest, I think, and to the concern about apathy, is underpinning all of this is a political system in which too many people have lost trust. Only 7% of British people think our elected politicians are acting in the national interest. Two-thirds of us think they're acting in their own interest. That is not sustainable. So we'll only get good economic policy making when we rebuild trust in politics, which has to be about driving vested interests and corruption out of our system.
Thank you. Sam?
So France is a third more productive than the UK, despite the fact that they take all of August off and have various mad labour laws and all the rest of it. And the reason for that, and it speaks to your question, is because they get the basics right. Childcare is cheaper, energy is cheaper, housing is cheaper, transport is cheaper. And childcare aside, three of those are about making it easier to build stuff. And I think that speaks to how you should all vote in this election. You should vote for the party that is going to make it easier to build stuff. The big coming debate over the next 5 years, I do not think, is going to be between the parties. It's going to be within parties. It's going to be between the builders and the blockers, and you should buy the builders.
Yeah, Sam, you've talked a lot about France, and I feel like at drinks we now have to ask you about what you think is going to happen in the French election,
yeah.
Because I'm curious. To the question about what to subsidise, I kind of said it earlier, but I think to make it a lot easier for households to make green investments in their homes, and then also make it easier to move home so that you're then not stuck in that home after you've improved it, and that everyone has an incentive to improve their homes, whether or not they're going to stay in it forever. I will say that I will vote. I think you should all vote too. And because I would like to not lose my job today, I'm going to leave it at that.
Thank you all very much. For what it's worth, you asked about subsidisation. I think economics is hugely important. We should also be humble. Countries across the world have tried to subsidise families and birth rates. France, most particularly, 20 years ago, they started doing it. Japan, since. It has done first order nothing to the birth rate. So economics is hugely important, but there are lots of other forces going on. To the question of who I'd vote for, I think that all three of the parties are missing some huge issues that are on the table, which we've discussed, and maybe that's kind of political strategy. The one thing that I would point everyone to, and I share some background with Ed Davey, I've never worked with him, but he's been talking about disability, and particularly has disability in his family. That's something that I have had. And we need to remember we're in an ageing society, and whether you have it now or you have it in the future, everybody is going to face that issue. So for me, in terms of who has put an important thing on the table, which we weren't really discussing enough before, of the three parties, it's actually the Lib Dems. I'm not saying I'm going to vote for them, but I just think their strategy, they've elevated the debate in one area, and hopefully this panel have identified a few other areas from trade, from cost of living, from decent plans on investment, where the debate needs to be elevated in other areas. So I'd just like to thank our panel and invite you all to meet us for drinks outside.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.